Today's episode of the Axial Creative Podcast is brought to you by Literati. For a limited time, go to literati.com/creative for 25% off your first two orders. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I'm your host. I'm also the author of a bunch of books, The Accidental Creative, Die Empty, Louder Than Words, and the book Herding Tigers, which is about how to lead creative teams effectively. So if you've been listening to the show for a period of time and you would like to receive a weekly kind of like a deeper dive into what happens here on the podcast, you can do so by subscribing to the weekly newsletter at accidentalcreative.com/subscribe. If you jump on that list, you're going to get not only a link to each week's podcast in case you missed it, but also just some deeper reflections, deeper ideas, some principles, some things that I'm noticing, some things that I took away from the conversation, or even a transcript perhaps of the episode if it's a solo show. So again, you can join that list at accidentalcreative.com/subscribe and get a weekly deep dive into what happens here on the show. So a couple of weeks ago, I got an email out of the blue from someone saying, "Hey, I've been listening to your show, would love to chat, just kind of get to know one another a little bit." And he happened to mention at the very end of the email, "Oh, by the way, I'm the co-creator of a TV show called Chopped and a bunch of other TV shows." And immediately my eyes, you know, were the size of dinner plates because my family loves the show Chopped. As a matter of fact, for a number of years, we have on vacation, it's sort of been a tradition of ours that we watch an episode of Chopped, you know, as a family before we go to bed at night, which is kind of fun. It's just like a little tradition for us. And I thought, boy, it would be so great to have a conversation, A, about where ideas come from for TV shows and things of that nature, how you pitch those ideas, and B, just to kind of hear what the creative process looks like as you're taking an idea from development to, you know, obviously to being on the air. And so today's conversation is with Dave Knoll. As I mentioned, Dave is part of a duo of content creators called Keller and Knoll, and they created the show Chopped, as well as a number of other things, including a new podcast called Factorious. And so we're going to be talking with Dave today about his creative process and how he takes ideas from hunch or from instinct to the screen. Before we do, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by a brand new sponsor. We're super excited. It's Literati. All right, let me ask you. So many of us right now, we're at home and maybe we have our families at home. We have our kids at home. So with libraries, with schools, with bookstores shut down, how do you keep your kids learning and growing? Books from Literati, which is the number one book club for kids, are the best place to start. Literati is the subscription book club that makes it easy to find unique and interesting books for your kids by delivering great stories straight to your doorstep. Literati knows that home deliveries will be critical in meeting your need for uplifting educational materials in the coming weeks. And reading books together can help create time of adventure and bonding for your family and has real educational benefits. Kids who read books have better vocabularies and have longer attention spans. So what exactly is it? Each Literati box contains five beautiful books based on a theme and contains exclusive original art and a personalized note for your child. We received our first Literati box last month and my daughter loved it. She loved the books, but it also came with puzzles and exercises and things for the kids to do that relate to the theme of that month. It's so well done, so well curated. Literati actively curates stories that spark curiosity and soften the heart, which saves you hours of searching the store or scrolling through lists of mediocre books online. And Literati will always beat the Amazon list price. So for a limited time, you can go to literati.com/creative and get 25% off your first two orders. This is their best offer available anywhere. To get it, you have to go to literati.com/creative for 25% off your first two orders. Again, that's literati.com/creative. We love Literati. We know you're going to too. Literati.com/creative. And we thank Literati for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, it's so good to have on the show today, Dave Knoll. Dave is someone I've only recently met, but I'm thrilled to have him on the show because he is the co-creator of one of my kids' favorite shows, one of our family's favorite shows, Chopped. And we're going to have a conversation today about his creative process and, boy, a whole lot of other things. Dave, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's exciting for me to be on the show because you are the creator of one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh, so, wow. Well, that's so cool. We'll have a mutual admiration society right here. Great. So Dave, could you share a little bit about, tell us what you do. How do you describe what you do?
On one level, it's really simple. I have a business partner, Cleve Keller, who's a creative genius, and the two of us create TV shows for a living. Our specialty is formats, TV formats. So that's basically game and competition shows. Although really anything that you could see on the air for thousands of episodes, that's our goal. But basically, yeah, we create TV shows.
And that, I know saying create TV shows encompasses a lot, obviously, from, you know, the conception, the idea, you know, coming up with an idea all the way to having to, you know, refine it and pitch it and, you know, actually get it on the air somehow. You know, when you think about the process of creating a TV show, you think about that, you know, sort of soup to nuts process that you engage in. You know, where, like, how does that process begin for you? I mean, when do you think, okay, this is an idea that I think we might be able to run with?
It's crazy because it begins every day. So Cleve and I are either live with each other or we're on the phone and we're just constantly talking about ideas. And sometimes it comes from a network or a buyer calling and saying, this is what we're looking for. And giving us parameters, which we love because that to us is an exercise, it's a challenge. Or sometimes we challenge each other. We'll say crazy things like, oh, I was just watching the Rachel Ray show. What would be the perfect Rachel Ray primetime ABC show? Or well, you know, I was just watching this particular format, say Nailed It on Netflix. What would be the perfect version of Nailed It if it wasn't a cooking competition, if it was something else? And so we give each other these challenges and, you know, 99 times out of 100, nothing ever comes of it. But every once in a while you get, you know, you hit it and you get a show that lasts. I mean, really all we want at first is just to get a deal, just someone to believe in an idea as much as we do. So they put some money in it and we get to see it, whether it's a pilot or 5 episodes or 10 episodes. But then the next goal, obviously, is to get to that second season or third season. And then to look back and say, oh, shoot, that lasted 80, 90, 100 episodes or Chopped, which is now over 900 episodes around if you count the entire franchise around the world. But the answer is we do it every single day. And then, you know, when you're on the phone with a buyer or when you're planning on going in and pitching, then you're sitting there and you're just basically thinking, well, of all the things we've talked about recently, of all the things that really excite us, what is the very best? What is the best one to pitch to them today? And then you go in and pitch away. And then, you know, and then most of the time they turn you down and you just keep, you get up the next day and do it again.
So how do you, you know, let's say you have an idea, you know, and it's, I mean, typically ideas, you know, I've spoken to songwriters, I've spoken to authors, I've spoken to a lot of people in different creative fields. And typically that first idea is, I mean, there's a spark there, but it's kind of like a diamond in the rough, right? It's not necessarily what the finished idea ends up being. Typically creative ideas don't arrive in fully formed fashion. What does your process look like of refining that idea and getting it ready to pitch?
It depends on the show. Interesting, we have watched a lot of interviews with a lot of creatives, people like you were just talking to, and the closest thing we've found by far is writing a pop song. When you hear somebody like Chris Cornell or Paul McCartney talk about songwriting, or there's a great show on NBC right now called Songland, and yeah. and little bits of it you can get from the show. It's very similar to that. You get a spark of an idea, and maybe it's a shot. You know, maybe it's just one shot. You're like, oh, there would be a great game show if this happened. Like, I've never seen that before. Or maybe it's a title. We go a lot based on great titles. Wow, that's such a cool title. I feel like we could sell that. We sold a show once called No Kitchen Required, and it literally, we just loved that title. We're like, okay, what's the show? And we ended up selling it to the BBC. We were so thrilled. And it just depends. We have a game show now called America Says, and that literally came from three different show ideas. We had been working on one game show where we loved the hook of the show. Like, we just love this hook. And then we were working on one game show where it had a very unique structure, and we loved that structure. And at one point, we're talking at that point to the USA Network, and they had they were really interested in this game that we pitched them, but they had some notes, and I remember it like it was yesterday, because it was such an explosive moment where I was walking back from the train. I was on the phone with Cleve, and we realized if we took the hook from one of our shows and the structure of a second show and then the title of a third show, that would be the new version of America Says. And it totally worked, and you know, sometimes you get it right. And so now that show has been ordered up through episode 450. But that took, you know, we worked on each one of those other shows, say, for a year. So it's like a year of working on that, and a year, not constantly, but a lot of work on one show, a lot of work on another show, and a title from a show from 2 years ago or whatever. And then all of a sudden it comes together in the perfect moment.
You know, that's such an important point, because I think often, you know, people who are in create on demand industries, which you are, you know, if people are, say, they're in advertising or marketing or something like that, often you do a project and you have all these ideas that come up in the midst of the project, and then they just go on a giant trash heap of old discarded ideas. And they're forgotten. You know, we just kind of leave them behind.
Yes.
But it's important to keep those ideas around, to keep them in some repository where you can go back later and maybe shuffle through them and say, hey, does anything that we thought about, you know, 6 months ago apply to what we're trying to solve now? Because often it's taking those old ideas and reconfiguring them in a way that actually solves the problem in front of you, that creates the spark or the insight or the breakthrough.
100%. I mean, one of the things I think make Cleve and I good at this, one of the reasons we're so successful at it, is because our brains in this particular way work in the same way. We only remember, because your brain, right, can only remember so much. Yeah. We only remember the best part of each thing, or the worst part, but we only remember the best part of each thing. So Cleve will call and she'll say, hey, I was thinking about, you know, or I came across this title from 5 years ago. Whatever it is, and instantly I won't remember the structure of it or who we pitched it to or why they turned it down or any of it, but I'll remember the one great thing about it. And so we have all these lists of show titles, and often with the show title, I'll just write a sentence or two just to remind myself, here, this show called The Family, the Friends, and the Fortune. Here's why we love it so much. And it's just a sentence. And that way, when you're looking through that list again and again and again, you're just remembering all these lights, all these different colored lights. And maybe you pick up that one from over here, the blue one, and then one from over here, that light green one, and then this other one over here, the orange one, and then it makes a new thing. And so when people say, you know, I'm in a creative industry, what's one thing I can do? I often say, well, keep some sort of list, keep some sort of set of cards, so those great things don't go on the trash heap. You know, throw out 95% of it, but the part that you really love, the part that like really got you going about it. And if, you know, if you work on something for even, at least with Cleve and I, even if we work on something just for a couple hours, there's a reason, whether it's a title or something, some sort of magic. And don't let that magic die. Let all the rest of it can go, but keep that one bit of magic, because you can use it again.
Oh, that's such good advice. Okay, I want to talk about something that came up in an interaction we had before we started recording. It was something you learned earlier in your career that I think is counterintuitive advice, and that is to never think big. What does that mean? Because I mean, we hear like think big, right? We hear all these people all the time shouting this, think big, think bigger. You're not thinking big enough, but you're saying never think big.
Well, and that is the lesson we learned from Barry Diller, who we worked with for 4 years. So if you're a listener and you don't know Barry Diller, and you should definitely look him up and read whatever you can about him. We worked with him for 4 years, and you know, I like to say of the 50 smartest things I know about creativity and show business and television, he said, you know, 42 of them in those 4 years. And the other 8 I just picked up along the way, the other, you know, part of my career. But what you learned from Diller is if you think big, if you think there's a lot of big thinkers out there and you're just like everybody else. So here's an example. So we had been working with him for not long, say about 5 or 6 months. And right away, almost right away, we had this idea for a show that we thought was brilliant with the perfect talent. And we called up the talent and he thought it was brilliant. And we knew the target network to go to. And so I think maybe we pitched it 3 times or 4 times. And the target, by the way, this all never happens. It's never this amazing. It's never this perfect. And then the target network had a couple of tweaks to the format, but they loved the whole package. And we got the call that in television, at least, you never get, hey, we want to go straight to series. We want to go right to 10 episodes. We don't need to do a pilot. We don't need to do any development step. We're just going to give you 10 episodes. And as we had further discussions, the budget became pretty big. So it was the 10 episodes were maybe a $5 million, $6 million budget. And I was so excited because at that point I was a big thinker and I was like, you know, this is big. This is great. We're the best. We've only been here for 5 months. And it was my job at that point to go in to the boardroom once a month with all with Mr. Diller at one end and all these scary people, lawyers and money people. And we knew exactly how to put the presentation together and how he liked it and all the analysis that had to be done. So we did all the analysis and I was so thrilled. Like literally that day where you're like, I'm going to wear my best tie and my best jacket. I'm going to look amazing. And I go in with my papers and everything's handed out and printed in full color. And I make this full presentation and everything for Mr. Diller had to be, you know, quick and concise. And so I go through the presentation, I go through all 5 pages, you know, and I say, we don't need a development step, all this other stuff. And he was not easily impressed, you know, at any time, but he definitely looked not impressed. And I felt myself getting more and more desperate and trying to smile bigger, you know, like bringing a little bit more personality. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, this is great. What do you like? This is amazing. I'm sure he loves it. And then, when I finished the presentation, there was a beat. And then he said, so why are we doing this again? And I was jolted and I was like, oh, he's just wants me to give the headlines again. This is just him saying, you know, what are the headlines? So I gave him the headlines again in like 20 seconds. And I remember because it had a binder clip. The pilot papers had a binder clip. And the reason I remember it had a binder clip was because I remember the sound of the binder clip as he threw the papers at me across the table, just slid them. And the binder clip, just that sound of the clip sliding over, over to me. And he said, and I'll clean up what he said, but he said, it's an effing lemonade stand. And I was completely blown away. And I just remember like looking at him and I think I was absolutely shocked. And I think I said like, come again. Or something. And I was in the room with a good friend of mine, Ricky Van Veen, and Ricky afterwards was like, the look on your face was complete shock, man. And then what he explained that day, and then what we learned very quickly is to someone like Barry Diller, billionaire, started the Fox Network, et cetera. Now, you know, the chairman of IAC, to him, a show like that, and he said it, he was like, look, I know the talent you're working with. This whole show is created around that talent. That means you can't do a version in Italy. You can't do a version in France. You can't sell this anywhere else. The talent you're talking about is a fairly difficult person to work with. It'll never last more than two or three seasons. So congratulations. You know, the most you'll possibly make per season is X. So multiply that times three. You know, you've just made me whatever that is, $5 million. Who cares? It's a lemonade stand. And what we eventually learned after talking to his entire team was, okay, don't go in there with any show, anything. Don't even talk about it unless you see a clear, concise path, an obvious pathway to $100 million, period. And that level of, so that when we say never think big, it basically means if you're thinking big, there's people out there that are thinking so much bigger than you. So you have to throw out whatever you think is big. You have to just toss it in the garbage because it, in, at least in television, the stakes are so much bigger and there's so much more potential. Don't think big, think huge, think enormous, retrain your brain, whatever you've learned, whatever you've thought about, it's just not big enough.
You mentioned, you give the story about Will Smith. I would love for you to share that. When you say that Will Smith didn't think big, what does that mean?
I've been able to meet Will Smith a couple times. And what you realize about him is his personality live is exactly like you would imagine it to be. He is a, you know, 1,000-watt star. And I don't know if it's every moment of every day, but certainly every meeting I've been in with him, it's enormous. And the story that I have read about him many times is there was a point where he had just been in a couple small parts in movies. And he was the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And he went to his manager and he said, look, I don't want to take any movie. And the manager was basically like, well, you know, you're just a TV guy. You should take any movie you can get. And he said, look, no, I don't want to just be a movie star. I want to be the biggest movie star in the world. How do we do that? And so they did what seems obvious, but is brilliant because it made all the sense in the world. They went and they looked at what the top 10, 20 movies were in history at that point, and they just searched for patterns. And what Will says is they found that time and time again at that point, what you saw was the top movies had special effects, they had creatures of some sort, and then there was a love story. And so he just flat out said, I'm not going to do any movie. I'm not going to mess around with this. I'm not going to do any movie unless there's special effects, there's creatures, and there's some sort of love story. And then you look at his career after that, and it is Independence Day and Men in Black and Men in Black 2. And you can see, oh, that was his goal. He wasn't just thinking big. He wasn't just saying, I want to be a movie star. He wasn't just saying, I want to be in movies. He wasn't just saying, oh, I want to work with the best director. It was, I want to work with the best directors, with the best scripts, and I want to be the biggest movie star in the world. And when you're thinking big, it's possible that maybe you're just not thinking big enough. And what you need to do is multiply that times 10.
There's a level of creative aggression in what you're describing, right? And I don't mean aggression in a negative way. I mean, you know, a willingness to say, I'm not going to apologize for my ambition. I'm going to go after what I believe I want creatively. And I think some people, maybe some creative pros, are a little bit timid about that. I think that they fear really aggressively going after what they want because they're embarrassed by it, or because they feel like maybe they're not worthy of that ambition or that goal. What would you say to those people?
100 I see that all the time. And then Cleve and I, you know, we also feel it, right? Because we're people. Sure. And we're humans, and people will, it is an industry that is so much fun, and so enjoyable. And there are days that you just can't believe it. I mean, I'm a kid from a very, very small town in New Jersey, right on the New Jersey-Pennsylvania border. Basically a whole bunch of cornfields, and then there's Belvedere, which is where I grew up. And there's moments in show business where I just can't believe I'm there, like a lot. Yeah. And yet on the other hand, it's scathingly horrible sometimes. It's really like torturously terrible. And you have to fight through that. And another mantra that that we say time and time again is, in selling things, and when you're an entrepreneur, which is kind of how we define ourselves as creative entrepreneurs, there has to be no failure and no fear ever. And when you feel it seeping in, you have to just immediately do something else. You have to immediately start creating something, get excited about something, remind yourself of something that you were excited about, and get excited about it again. Because if you let the fear stop you even for a day, like that could have been the day you create the next chopped or the next America Says, or that could have been the day you put the phone call in to call about that. And yes, you have to face the insults and I've had network executives say to me, well, you're not really a producer, you're more of a sales guy. And I'm like, I can't punch you in the face right now because that, you know, we're in a meeting. But other than that, you know, it wrecks your soul, and you have to just fly through that and say, "Who, you know, that's just crazy." Like, you know, my whole job is to create something, and then yes, to sell it, or else, like, I've created plenty of stuff that are, you know, there's beautiful artwork done or great logos that are just sitting, you know, in my office. If I don't sell it, it never makes anybody's TV sets.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That no failure and no fear, period. And you hear that from other creatives. Stephen King has the best story ever about that. And that was when he was young, like say 12 years old. He, you know, was just a kid that he had no entrance into writing or publishing or anything. But he heard that you could submit your stories to publications and that anyone could do that. And that blew his mind. He was like, oh, I could actually write something and put it in a manila envelope and send it off with a cover letter and they might actually consider it. He almost couldn't believe it. And the day he got his first rejection. So you can imagine this, other 12-year-olds, you get rejected from a publication that you love. And you're depressed. You're like, oh my gosh, my writing isn't good enough. He did exactly the opposite. He said he was so thrilled that anyone, any publication that he loved, would have actually considered his work and that actually wrote back. He was so thrilled. He immediately went up to his bedroom. He had these eaves above his bed and he banged a nail into one of the eaves and he immediately put the rejection letter up. And he said at that moment in time, I wasn't even about selling a story. It was about how many rejection letters could I get? And he said at one point there was so many rejection letters that the nail, they didn't fit on the nail anymore. And so he had to take the nail out and he got this giant wooden spike and pounded the spike into the eaves again. And then there were more rejections could fit up there. And that's, he just kept writing and he just kept submitting and he was excited by the no. And that's the Cleve and I, like, anytime anybody turns down anything, again, it's hard. And as I say, fairly often, actually, people are pretty mean about why they're turning something down. Yeah. Or direct, I guess, is a better way of saying it. You know, here's why we think this show just doesn't work. And, you know, we've done a ton of work on it, and they're saying it doesn't work. And we're like, of course it is. It's genius. We're the creators of Chop. You're crazy. You just have to immediately go, oh, okay, that's just a step towards success. We need 29 no's before we get to the one yes anyway.
Yeah.
So, I read it in a book at one point, 15, 20 years ago, Brandon Tartikoff, who was one of the great TV minds of all time and ran NBC for a decade or more, said, even if you have the best show ever, even if you have Friends or Survivor or Wheel of Fortune or whatever, the odds are you're going to have to pitch it 30 times because the other 29 times, people aren't going to get it. People are going to be busy that day. They're not going to have the money. They're not going to be looking for that type of show. It's just, it's not you. It's just the show's great. You're just going to, you need 29 rejections. And so Cleve and I just keep in mind, like, okay, someone just turned down that show. That's just rejection number 8 or rejection number 24 on our way to number 30.
Yeah. Yeah. I those stories are just so unbelievable about, you know, I mean, things like, you know, the Beatles being turned down by every record label, you know, like multiple times, and even like having rejection letters from every record label. Those stories abound of people who are at the absolute top of their game because they just say, hey, I'm not going to let that rejection.
And you just have to do it. And it's weird, right? Because at that point at age 12, it's not that Stephen King, you know, is some sort of psychological genius or he had more maturity or whatever.
Right.
He just kind of had the right personality. He almost lucked out. Yeah. Oprah talks about the same thing. And it's amazing when Oprah launched her talk show. She'd been on the news. She had done morning shows. But when she launched her talk show in Chicago, she said it was freeing because everyone, my bosses, everyone at the station, everyone I knew, everyone said, you're definitely going to fail, because it was her up against Phil Donahue, who at that time was a giant star. And she was going right up against Phil Donahue. So she was like, it was actually great because I just felt like, well, there's no way I can succeed. So it doesn't really, like, I'll just go and enjoy myself and have the best time ever and make the best show possible. And then she became Oprah Winfrey. And that's really any creative. That's what you have to throw all possible negativity totally out the window, to completely go past it and say, you know what? My vision, my excitement, my expertise, everything I know, it's going to work this time, even though the odds are it's not going to.
So you're venturing into new territory. You know, you've been creating TV shows, but you just entered a new medium. You just launched a new podcast called Factorious. Tell us about the podcast.
Absolutely crazy. And we love it so much. We were working on this TV game show, and it was called Factorious. And we had this whole show planned with 3 teams and a giant, you know, game show big board. And out of nowhere one day, our agents called and said they had a conversation with Endeavor Audio, which is now one of my favorite companies ever, obviously. And Endeavor Audio was basically just looking for things that were different in podcasting. So things, there's a lot of comedians in podcasting. There's a lot of news. There's a lot of all this stuff. There's a lot of, and they were looking for different types of things. And so our agent said, do you guys have anything? And they were even talking about like a singing competition maybe, or, you know, anything else. And Cleve and I were like, well, we'll think about it. But on the call, we were like, I don't know. Like, we just never thought about it before. And then we hung up, we met. And in that first meeting, obviously we had listened to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So we knew there were games on podcasts, but nothing like a Wheel of Fortune or nothing like a Jeopardy or a Family Feud. And so in the conversation, we got real excited about the possibility of, wow, if you could create the first Wheel of Fortune, right, for podcasting, it would be legendary. And we were going like, well, what of our shows doesn't need visuals? Because obviously something like Wheel of Fortune, you couldn't do on a podcast. You need [S2] Right. [S1] To see that board. But very early on with, we thought, oh, well, with Jeopardy, you could play that, right? Those are just questions, and then people answer. You don't need that board. And the interesting thing is, when we were creating Factorious, we kept saying to ourselves, what we wanted was the structure of Jeopardy, right? We wanted trivia, some sort of structure like Jeopardy, but the tone of Wheel of Fortune. We want that kind of like, anybody can watch this, anyone can solve the puzzle tone of Wheel of Fortune. So we kept saying to ourselves, at least, Factorious was Jeopardy meets Wheel of Fortune, which is hilarious, right? Because that would be the most successful show, you know, ever.
Right.
And so we went crazy because we're like, oh my gosh, Factorious, if you take out the board and you just make it 3 players, the way we ask the question is so different and so unique and has never really been done before. This could work as a podcast. And so right away, we called a couple people into the room, and everyone, you know, we said, close your eyes. And we played Factorious, and it worked instantly. We were like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And so called the agent, said, schedule that meeting right away. We're going to go in and we're going to play Factorious. And we went in and played Factorious for the room. One woman who works there, who we absolutely love, came up with the idea to blindfold everyone. So I hosted the game. We had three people from their office play, and they could see me and I could see them. And there were buzzers and sound effects and music and everything. But everyone else in the room, the entire Endeavor Audio staff, had blindfolds on. And later we found out the head of Endeavor Audio basically was like, by the time you got to the second question, I had already bought 50 episodes of that show. It didn't matter to me who the host was. It didn't matter anything. He's just like, I knew we had to try this.
That's great.
And so that it was, so it just premiered. Our host is Matt Eisman, who is absolutely hilarious. He's the host of American Ninja Warrior on NBC, and he's been doing that for 10 years. He's an absolute pro. All of our contestants completely love him, and it was a joy to work on. And for us, crazy easy, because it was like, a third of the work.
Yeah. So do you think you might do more podcasts?
Oh my gosh. We absolutely will do more podcasts. Even if I'm just doing them myself.
Yeah.
We had a absolute blast and people really loved it. The contestants would come, they'd have a shot at winning $1,000, and a lot of people won money. And they played with Matt Eisman, and there were buzzers and headsets and music and all of that, all the bells and whistles. And, we could tape 6 episodes, 7 episodes in a day, 'cause it was so easy. You know, there's no cameras, there's no director, there's no, all of those things that Cleve and I are so used to. We're like, oh, we had a blast, an absolute blast. So I hope that shines through on the show. When I listen to it, I at least am having a blast. But we'll see what happens. Obviously, you know, launching a podcast is just as difficult as launching a TV show.
Sure. That's amazing. Well, congratulations. I'm super excited to listen. Actually, even listen with the family. And
yes, please do.
Yeah, and I know they've been huge fans of we mentioned you have Chopped, and I know that this is going to be a great, especially right now, this is probably a really good thing to do as a family.
That's as I say, the initial thing was the tone of Wheel of Fortune, that show where you can watch with your 8-year-old, or you can watch with your, I have a 97-year-old grandmother and a 12-year-old daughter. And every question we wrote for Factorious, I kept saying to myself, but I kept saying to everybody, Rebecca needs to be able to have a shot at guessing this, and she's 12. And my grandmother, Graham, needs to be able to have a shot at guessing this, and she's 97. So no matter what your answer is, whether the answer is bubblegum or Disney World or Oprah Winfrey, it's got to be something that is so well known that the 12-year-old knows the answer, mm-hmm, and the 97-year-old knows the answer.
Yeah. Well, Dave, this has been so much fun. Thanks for taking the time to share with us today. If people want to come find you online, where can they find Dave Knoll?
Instagram and Twitter. It's at Dave Knoll TV. So DAVENOLL TV. There's no K. Everyone wants to add a K. or LinkedIn. Just find me on LinkedIn. A lot of people do.
Amazing. Well, Dave, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, or at accidentalcreative.com/subscribe. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.